Bante, my question, why are we here? Big one. What's the purpose of life? Sadhu. Ah, human beings are the same. I was in India as a young boy, still a Christian, and all of a sudden, this question started buzzing around. And then I went to a lady, a very spiritual lady. It's called Vimala Thakkar. Vimala Thakkar was one of the, according to the book I read by Ann Cohen, who's an American spiritual teacher, she was one of the most enlightened female on earth. When I met her, I didn't know. It just came later on when I went to the United States. I had this famous teacher, it's called Ann Cohen. She went to India to interview this lady. And according to her research, she was the most enlightened woman under the sun. So, if you don't know this lady, she's called Vimala Thakkar. She was born in India. And she's the one who succeeded Krishnamurti. Who knows about Krishnamurti? Yes, Krishnamurti was frustrated. He taught for many years. He was a spiritual giant, Krishnamurti, very scientific in his approach and very radical also. So he taught for many years in USA, in Switzerland and all that, in Holland. And people still following him. I said, why are you following me? I thought you got the message. But finally, there's one person whom he authorized to teach. He's called Vimala Thakkar. Once he taught Vimala Thakkar, he said, you've got my message. Go and on top of the roof in India and preach. Teach people my message that you got it. So anyway, this lady, I used to follow her also when I was in India as a student. I used to visit her and I went there. The first time I went, that was I think 1992, she had a question and answer session. And this is the very question I asked, why are we here? Okay, I don't remember the questions, I mean the answers. I forgot what she answered, but anyway, I can attempt to answer this question according to wisdom. Why are we here? Why not? Why not here? What's wrong with being here? Have you ever thought, why not? Okay, we are here to attain ultimate freedom, liberation. That's the reason why we're here. Everything we do should be in that service. It should serve that purpose. In fact, this connects with what's the purpose of life. So, two in one. Cut two carrots with one knife. I heard that there is a saying with kill two birds with one stone. Buddhists don't kill, so we just cut now. We cut two carrots with one knife. So your question, what's the purpose of life, is to gain ultimate enlightenment, nibbana. The purpose of life is to overcome suffering and attain ultimate happiness. That's the purpose. And that's why we're here. So you are eating today, what meal are you going to eat? Let's say if you are going to eat kiribati, if you are going to eat, I don't know the Australian food. Okay, you are eating that food in that service, to serve that purpose. Maybe you're coming here to meditate, you're doing the same thing. Okay, what about people who are not meditating or who don't know about Buddhism and all that? Also, actually what they are doing is indirectly connected to our purpose. All people want to be happy, actually. all people, whether you buy a car today or you get a new girlfriend or a new wife, what you are looking for is actually happiness. Let's say if I buy this car, what I'm looking for is happiness, that when I'm taking this water, I'll quench my thirst and my thirst will go and I'll be happy. It all boils down to happiness. We say Nibbana, but I want to say ultimate also happiness, so ultimate freedom. All those are words that I think are the same. Ultimate peace, ultimate liberation, ultimate freedom. Okay, it's very, very clear that all beings don't want to suffer and all beings want to be happy. Isn't it? Even an insect, the smallest insect, you can do even an experiment. Look at an insect, don't put a big thing to hurt it. Just get a small stick and then it's an insect moving and block it. I've never seen an insect which goes over the stick. It will just go that way. Even the tiniest insect, you see it walking, block it, it will go another way. So even that small insect with this consciousness, smallest consciousness, it senses danger, doesn't want to suffer. It wants to be happy. So the purpose of life is to attain ultimate happiness. Of course, we may not attain it in the same day, but all these small pieces we are doing in our life is serving that purpose. Right? Whether you do it, you know it or not, or whether you label it Buddhism or not. So all of us, we are here to attain final liberation. We have other people call it moksha. That's Hindus. It's about liberation. The Christian call it heaven, to reach heaven. And that's also happiness. They expect to get lots of gold there and everything is beautiful. Very happy. The most unfortunate part, everybody want to go to heaven, but nobody want to die. So, right there, conflicting interest. But they want to be here, to go to heaven. All religions, actually, what's very interesting, are directly or indirectly connected to going somewhere which is envisioned to be a very happy place or happy conditions. Right? Some people, very smart, they say that the purpose of life is no purpose. Oh, that's a big one. I've seen people saying that the purpose of life is that there's no purpose. It's purposeless. We have some schools that claim that the purpose of life is no purpose. Why should life have a purpose? The question like that. I've been on so many conferences where people talk about, these are people like Muslim and rabbis. I think I attended a conference in Japan a couple of years ago, and it was this famous Muslim and rabbi and all that. It's very interesting to hear people's view, saying that this is all wasted of time reading books and all that. When a baby is born, it's not born with a manual, operating manual. Really, to what they should do, eat and do this. Just go in life. There's no need to read a book. So somebody said like that. Babies don't come with an operation manual whereby they have to read what they have to do, go into a restaurant. They just open. So they said it's just a wastage of time, really actually trying to read and understand the mechanics behind peace and life. And it all come naturally. So people have weird idea, but this is a question, and the purpose of life is to attain enlightenment. Everything you're doing is actually serving that purpose. It doesn't matter what you're doing. Indirectly, you really want to be happy, whether you're driving a car, whether you're going to vacation in Sri Lanka or Uganda. It doesn't matter what you're doing. Everything is connected that to be happy and not to suffer. Did Buddha encourage monks, Sangha, to build monasteries? Oh, that's also a very good question. Did Buddha encourage monks and saints to build monasteries. Well, where would they stay? Anyway, what's very interesting is during the time of the Buddha, monasteries were offered by the Sangha, Anattapindika. If the Buddha discouraged it, then he would refuse it, isn't it? So please, monks are not supposed to have monasteries. They have to stay on the trees like birds. The Buddha would give us that example. There is no single monastery, at least to my knowledge, that the Buddha refused. Jetavana Grove, and he spent many years in a monastery. That's very interesting. In the beginning, actually, monks were wanderers, like others. They used to wander in the very beginning, just like me when I began in Uganda. I was just wandering with a mobile temple because there was no monastery. But later on, things changed. Okay, this is the beginning. Monks, we are wanderers. The only time they stay in one place, and that came later on, is during Wasa. And that was not originally the Buddhist way. It was actually the Jains. The Jains, these ascetics, they had these ascetic practices and very scrupulous about the non-violence. So they didn't want to kill any insect. Even some of them stayed naked. Others, they had to put on a mask not to kill any insect when you're breathing, and they had to sweep wherever before they walk, they sweep somewhere. Can you imagine such scrupulous practitioners? So then, during rain season in India, that's when it lasts always 3 months. So the ascetics used to stay in one place, and the Buddha's monks were wanderers. And then they say, you the Sachan people from this clan following the Buddha, you don't maintain good ethics. During rain season, you walk and trample over insects and you kill them, and you're claiming that you're pure. No, you are not. We are. So then the Buddha adapted it so that during that time, monks have to stay in one place. But after that, they will take off. So they will be wanderers. Later on, slowly, settlement started. Small kutis were built, and the monks started a settled life. And then they kept on settling in a monastery. And later on, they even moved on the cities, actually. They had a permanent dwelling in even the cities, but it started very far away in the forest and all these things. So yes, one thing is the beginning, how the Buddhist ministry started, is that they were wanderers, except for 3 months. And later on, once they started 3 months, they actually continued on, staying after 3 months, they would continue, and then they became permanent settlers. This practice is still actually practiced. Many monks actually, they travel a lot, except Wasa. Wasa time, they stay in one place. Yes, but there are other monks who actually don't travel at all. They just stay in one place throughout the years, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. But there's some monks like Ajahn Brahm. they travel a lot. Many monks, my teacher Bhante Gunaratana travels a lot. The only way you can see, you could see him now not traveling a lot. The only time you could see him in one place is during Wasa, 3 months. But even that would chop it half, maybe 1 month, because you can observe late Wasa also. Yeah, so some of us, we have a very heavy schedule, actually. Very heavy schedule, and we still travel, but this time, during 3 months, we want to observe it. Yes. I think the Buddha encouraged the monks and nuns to have monasteries. I don't expect the monks actually build themselves a monastery. This is something was offered by lay people. But sometime monks might be able to find out resources actually and build themselves. but it's something that was offered to the Sangha, like the way you are doing probably. Yeah, the way you are doing, your new Berry monastery, you are offering, you get all the funds and then build it and offer to the Sangha and build a monastery. But that's not always the case. Some monks, it may not be easy that way, like in the United States. Some monks themselves have to travel around the world, and they are supported. They give the people give the resources, and they have to figure out how to start the monastery. I think that's what Bhante Gunanathan also did. Actually, he had to go to Canada and raise some money with a lay person, and they donated money, and then he came and planned everything. It was not like sitting there, oh, let me wait for the lay people to offer. No, it was much of the effort that he did. Same applies to me. I had to travel to Canada, many places, and I started the place in Uganda, because if I wait for Ugandan people to offer the monastery, it will be never. Yeah, so I think he encouraged, because he received the monastery. Why did you become a monk? This answer is very easy. Why did I not become a monk? That's very easy. We don't have to dwell on that. If you're interested to know why I became a monk, there's a book actually about it. I just come from Thailand, and there was a big book launch. 1,000 people came, and then this book was sold. 10,000 copies was printed. They were printed, 10,000 copies were printed, and they were using this book to collect money for the Nepal victims or earthquake. Yes, so it was a big launch, and they collected a lot of money, and they're going to send it, I think, to Nepal. And this book is called Planting Dharma Seeds. Planting Dharma Seeds, the Emergence of Buddhism in Africa. In that place, I recount how I became a Buddhist to start with, and how I became a monk, and how I built the Ugandan Buddhist temple. But if you want a live story, I can tell you just in a few minutes. How I became a monk is, I got inspired in Buddhism in 1990 when I went to study in India. I went to study business in India, and it was an exchange program between Uganda and India. So I saw two monks from Thailand for the first time in my life. I saw two monks. They were studying at the university, in Punjab University in Chandigarh. So when I saw them, they had this wonderful smile, and in their robes, they looked so happy. And I said, wow, this is the happiest people I've ever seen. So they gave me food, they gave me clothes, they gave me everything. When I was looking at other people, they were not so happy, especially the Indians. Maybe they were happy inside, but outside they are not happy. By the way, this is Chandigarh in northern India. There's people called the Sikhs. They have turbans, and they have a lot of beard. And they have a moustache like this. Even when they smile, you cannot see the smile. Maybe that's the reason. These monks were shaved with all their eyeballs and everything. And so when they smile, any attempt to smile, I could see it. Maybe that's the reason. And I needed some smile, because I come from Uganda. People are very happy, mostly, and they smile. And these people are so tough, actually. The Punjabis, those with those things, the Sikhs like this, I thought they were too serious for life. Unserious people, you can find them in a hospital. And these people are not in a hospital. You know, if you want to find serious people, go in a hospital. We are not in a hospital. And these people are so serious for life. Every sick person I looked, is so serious. And I looked at these monks shining, with bald head and robes. And I was like attracted to them like a magnet, actually. And when I looked at them, they looked like as if they are friends for many years, actually. I hung around with them, and people ask me, why are you hanging around with such people? What are you talking to them? My fellow Ugandans, there were two Ugandans that I found there. I say, these people are wonderful, I like them. So anyway, they took me to the temple, and I saw the first Buddha statue in my life. There's a temple in Chandigarh. It's only one temple there, a Buddhist temple. And I saw the big Buddha statue there. And then I gave food to the monk. And then the monk told me they have to eat first, and then we eat last. I said, why? I want also to have that one. Why do I have to wait until monks eat, and then I eat last? Anyway, I had to learn that also. And so slowly by slowly I learned Buddhism. I got interested in Buddhism. Unfortunately, they left for Thailand, and I looked for monks. And then I later on got to know there's a monk called Dalai Lama in northern India. So after my examination, off on a bus to Dharamsala. And then I saw His Holiness the Dalai Lama. We had to submit the passport and register and all that. And then I met him in public. Then I met him again, another monk who was very kind and full of compassion. I observed he was shaking Westerners, shake hand and put the white thing around him. When it reached me, kept on shaking. I think I was the only African there. I mean, then when I came back, all the people were very jealous about me. What were you talking with His Holiness the Dalai Lama? He was shaking all the time. So then I got to know him, and many times I went to meet him and get more inspiration. And I met Vimalathakar around the same time, 1992. I met him, met Vimalathakar, and I went there, and I was asking such question, why, what are we doing here, and all this kind of question. She answered them very well, and they recorded them and all this. So she was such a loving person. Then I got interested on the path slowly by slowly. And then 1994, I did the retreat, meditation, 12 days. Once I did meditation for 12 days, I said, wow, this is what I want in life. Very inspiring for meditation. I was so inspired by the meditation practice. And then the same year, I asked to meet His Holiness privately. All right? And then he scheduled an interview, 5 minutes private interview. When I went there, he was waiting for me in front there, in front of his house. He just saw off the journalist, and then he was just waiting for the next one to come, and then there was the next one. He held me like this, and then we walked to his place. I said, wow, this is such a person who's full of compassion and loving kindness. So I said, wow, these monks have something, you know. So anyway, long story short, I left India, got to Nepal, Tibet, Thailand, and scuba diving. And after scuba diving, 2 years, I left, went to Uganda. They want to convert me back to Christianity. I said, no, it's too late. So then I went to South America, ended up in the United States for three months, meditation for 3 months in 1999. Right, 1999, I went to meditate in the United States for 3 months. After this, within those 3 months, I reviewed life as a scuba diving instructor and as a traveler, backpacker. I've done a lot of things. I've been spent 1 year in South America traveling, so I reviewed all my life and said, what do I like in life? I found out the only way I can be happy, at least during that time I thought of what I can do to make me happy, is to find a way how I can continue to meditate. So I became a staff. I got a job in a meditation center, as a layman, I was a retreat manager at IMS, which is the biggest center, meditation center in the North America. So I got a job as a meditator, and then I remember the executive director was an Australian. He's called Edwin. Very kind man. Very always laughing and all that. I said, wow, I kind of see. I think work here, and continue to meditate as working and leading retreats managing retreats. Then, but since I was working in the same place where I spent 3 months, I said, wow, that would be wonderful to become a monk. Actually, during the 3 months, many teachers like Joseph Goldenstein and Sharon Schatzberg, we are talking about Sayadaw Pandita. Every talk, Sayadaw Pandita did like this, Sayadaw Pandita did like this. I said, wow, I think I should go to Burma and meditate and then become a monk. And then what's very interesting is that once I finished the 3 months, I heard that you can meditate in America. I didn't know that you can meditate in America because become a monk in America. When I went to America from the airport, I went to meditation cushion. So I didn't know America. I just knew just only that center. But after the 3 months, I heard you can ordain in America. You don't have to go to Burma. Once I got to know that information, and then I went. There's so many things that happened, but I want to give you a short story. Then I went to the monk. He's an assistant to Sayadaw Pandita. Not this Upandita here. This Upandita is around 92 years, actually. He's a major teacher of all these Upanditas you are hearing and everywhere here. But this is a major teacher who taught Sharon Schatzberg and all that. But his assistant was in San Jose. Burmese monk who is very serious, like him, actually. When I reached there, I told him I want to become a monk. I didn't know that actually you have to train to become a monk. He looked at me like this. I really had a burning desire to become a monk, right? And he said, no, you have to train. So I sat down and meditated. They gave me a small room. So I meditate. So he used to keep tabs on my practice. Every the other day I have to report my meditation. Then 15 minutes you have to go and report. And if you say, he would ask you, what time did you sleep? And you say 9. Say, why 9? You have to sleep at 10. What time you wake up? 4:30. Well, let's say you wake up at 4. Say, why didn't you wake up at 4? 4:30. You should wake up at 4. He's tracked down everything. And then during daytime, he would go for a walk. The first thing, he would look at whether I'm meditating or not. He was a very serious monk, actually. So I stayed there in San Jose and training to become a monk. And I was the only monk actually training in San Jose. So that's how I became a monk. Yeah, so. It's a long story, but that's a brief. Read my book. Okay, this question actually is dear to me. When I say why not, it was just if people ask me and I don't have time, I just tell them why not. But actually, it's more to that. So thank you for asking this question. Okay, dear Bante, please repeat the meditation acronym SPACE and its explanation. It was helpful. Thank you for your Dhamma teachings. All right. Okay, SPACE. I came up with this actually acronym, and it was for me, for my practice, because as a monk, I told you I go for vacation, right? Sometime long vacation, like for 1 month, especially after teaching in Brazil. In Brazil, every day I have to teach. It's not like here. Here I'm on a holiday. You people are so good. Buddhist Society of Victoria. It's all spaced out. But when I go to Brazil, almost like I teach like 9 days retreat. And here I teach only weekend. Very easy. And then there I have to go and give talks and this and that. And even then, if inside the house itself where I stay, they organize evening, there will be evening, let's say evening, there will be a talk that I give where I'm staying. And then some bees actually have a very busy schedule in Brazil. I have to fly to 5 cities. I keep on flying from Brasilia, then fly here, there, over there. So by the end of my trip in Brazil, like 3 months, I'm really worked out. I'm not say tired, but I really have worked hard. So what I do is always to go to a holiday. I go back to the United States. I just don't go to the monastery. I go to a place where I know is the best place to practice. It's called, my teacher named it as Hilton, Dharma Hilton. You want to know Dharma Hilton? Americans have built one, but actually that's not its official name. Its official name is called Forest Refuge. It's in the United States. It's next to IMS, where I did a 3-month retreat. This place, they have 30 rooms. Monks can meditate for free. It's a beautiful place. Always that's where I go for holiday, because it's a resort. Hilton. But this it's called so because you get everything you want. Very clean rooms. It's not like being in the Burma where snakes are peeping to see what you're doing. That's what happened to Nauyana. Nauyana, I always go to Nauyana, Medisripura, you know, Nauyana. I go to, it's in Sri Lanka. That's the place, another place I identified to go for holiday. Like 2 weeks, usually I go for my holiday for 2 weeks to meditate there. So sometimes I'm doing walking meditation, and then a snake is doing like this on a roof. So this is a big forest monastery. And last time I was there, actually, the snake bite the monk. Last time I was there, the monk, the leg was like this big. And the snake was so small. Anyway, Dharma Resort, such things are unlikely to happen, Hilton. But nevertheless, Sri Lanka and Burma is also a great place to go for holiday. Yes, but anyway, where am I now? I think I'm here. Space. Yes, I was telling you that actually I developed this because as a monk sometime, I take things for granted that I can manage things. So, but once I go start my holiday, like for 1 month, I found out I'm racing. I'm walking too fast. I said, how about not slowing down? And I could see the difference in my practice by just slowing down. And then also because I'm a monk, I've been meditating for such a long time also, sometimes I become impatient with my practice. Then I say, oh, why don't I settle back? It's okay, this breath. And then also I try not to push away things I don't want. And this kind of thing. I found out this was very helpful for me. Okay, we start. S in space stands for slowing down. Slowing down. Now, there's another S here that I didn't give you last time, this morning. Also, it stands for silence. Silence. Not, silence is not only keeping mum like this quiet, but also the inner chatter. Because sometimes we might keep quiet, but there's a lot of inner chatter there going on. It's like some of these things, these gadgets you have, sometimes you use them, but there's what you call inner program. Here it is showing this program, but inside there, there's a program behind running. Yeah, these iPod things and all the things. There's a program running. So most of us actually we come to meditate and we become very good yogi, keep quiet, nobody's talking. But inside there, cha, 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 a lot of chatter, right? So that's what we need to try as much as possible to also to reduce, right? In fact, the silence we keep here is called total silence. Total silence. By closing your eyes, your mouth, that's total silence. But real silence is noble silence. Really, actually, we should work towards that. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, if it's keeping silence will be the way to enlightenment, all dumb people will be enlightened. The people who don't speak, they will be enlightened. But that's not the case. So what should we do for silence? Not only just close our eyes, actually Buddha was even against that. though the Buddha is called a sage, Muni. Muni means sage, but sage means somebody who has silence. Silence was silence. But silence not keep quiet, silence the defilement. Somebody who have silenced the what? The mental defilement. That's what we should aim for, but not closing our eyes. I mean closing our mouth only. So S there stands also for aiming for that inner chatter, right? To try to be silent. That will make your practice progress faster if you can actually pay attention to the inner chatter and try to shut off the program behind. Right? So silence means slowing down and also in silence, real silence. Right? In fact, noble silence happened in the second jhana actually. That's what we call noble silence. In the retreats they put noble silence, but what they mean is actually total silence. Noble silence happens in the second jhana. That's where you don't have initial application of thought and sustained application of thought. It doesn't mean you have no thoughts, it's just you don't have conceptual thoughts basically. So you want to shut down as much as possible, not by just by mere energy, but actually slowly by slowly try to settle down your mind so that it doesn't have behind program running. Right? It will have some of them, but try as much as possible. I think Ajahn Brahm make a determination at the beginning of the meditation that I'm going to let go of the inner chatter. When they come, you can remember actually to try to overcome them by through determination. Okay, those S stands for silence and slowing down. P stands for patience. Patience with what? With the unfolding of your practice. The way how your practice unfolds, you should be patient. You should not be impatient. Try to attain enlightenment just in few seconds. Just put out the energy there and the effort and whatever it needs to do in your practice, get a good comfortable cushion, do every condition, try to put it together, but don't sit there and just, oh, poor me, I've been meditating for all these years, I was born a Buddhist, and all my family is pious Buddhists, they give dan and all that, I'm sitting here and I'm not getting any jhana, this kind of thing. No, don't do this kind of thing. Every time you sit and practice is a different time. Yeah, don't borrow from last time. Oh, you know, I've done 10 days Goenka course and now I'm sitting here the first time. I should be a better practitioner. I should be able to solve this insight. No. Take every seat as different from others, right? Just start from the beginning and then be patient with the unfolding of your practice. That's what P stands for, patience. A stands for attitude, which is proper. Your attitude should be proper because there are three attitudes which are not proper. Right? One is when you meditate to push away things. That's not a proper attitude. Pushing away things is aversion. There's another attitude people develop is trying to reach something, reaching out for something, leaning forward. That's attachment. And there's another approach, not a good attitude, is called ignorance. They ignore. When somebody has pain, I've seen this many times, people come to me and they say they had pain and all what they did is to push it away, they didn't want to face it, and they just want to watch the breath. So that's another thing which you don't want to develop. If you just ignore things, that's ignorance. So you want to keep these three attitudes away from your practice. One is basically not pushing away things, not indulging in things, and not ignoring things. You should be able to understand whether you have pain, you have to not push it away, not indulge in pain, and not ignore it. So A stands for attitude. It also stands for acceptance. That means wise acceptance. That means open to the experience. When whatever is arising, let it be part of the things that you have to observe. Not that, okay, I should observe the breath only, and when an emotion comes, oh, no, I shouldn't. I'm a good Buddhist. I should not feel anger now. Mm-hmm. Yes, I know people want to be holy. Eh? I'm a holy Buddhist. Eh? It's bad, really bad news to feel anger. So they don't accept. What happens is they don't accept what's arising in their experience. So here we have to practice acceptance. Accept whatever arises. Not being accepting or blindly, but I qualify it, accept wisely what's arising. That be able to investigate, to put it as part of your practice. And then A stands, pay attention also to everything. Don't leave out anything. Don't cut out anything that this is not meditation. As you meditating, and then you might go out and then reach up a cup of tea, that's also your meditation. When you're a meditator, according to the Buddha, everything you're doing is part of your meditation. Whether you're reaching out to douse the candle, whether you're getting water, whether you are anything. In fact, when we do that, paying attention to everything, whatever we're doing, then we can build the momentum of mindfulness. But some people, I found out, they have a tendency to think that meditation happens on this square mat. And once they leave, they become time bomb. Yes. One time, this is a true story. I meditated for 3 months and I went to Vermont. Up there, it's very, very cold. Very cold. Snow was up to here. I said, I'm not going to go out of this house for 2 weeks. I stayed on the computer. I wasn't accepting. I wasn't accepting weather. Can you imagine not to accept weather? Who's gonna win? I said, no. After 2 weeks, I said, I really should accept this weather. And I started going skiing. When I went skiing, actually cross-country skiing, I learned how to do cross-country skiing. And it was just normal. I enjoyed. I started enjoying weather. Because now I'm accepting whether it's cold or not. But there was that sense of acceptance. And I was embracing. I didn't care how cold it is. So I accepted. And I remember one morning I was meditating. Dogs came. Then I thought, oh, these dogs are going to kill my meditation. In other words, kill. They're disturbing my meditation. They should leave me alone. You know, they're coming, licking me and all this kind of thing, you know. So I let alone learned that actually if I'm to become a good meditator, dogs would come and lick me and just continue to meditate. Depends on where they lick anyway, so. You get the gist, actually. So S stands for acceptance. It stands for attitude. It stands for attention also. Okay, C. C stands for continuity of your practice. Once you've done actually the things in A, you should be able to have continuity of practice. The practice actually is not to be practiced in fits and starts. It's actually continuity. It's like in those old days where they start fire. They had to roll a stick like this. If they roll like this and stop, again they roll like this, they cannot. It's continuous effort to keep on doing like this, and then fire started. So meditation also is like that. You have to continue the practice in whatever we are doing. Let it be some form of continuity and I've demonstrated it actually from here when I lead meditation, from sitting, then standing, even for a short time, and then walking, and then from walking, come back to stand, come back to sit. There should be a kind of a seamless flow of your practice. Not, okay, sitting, meditation finish, end. Then you go out and you're out of meditation. And then you are breaking it. There's no continuity, right? So continuity is very, very important, very, very important. And the teachers will remind you that a lot, especially where we practice in Burma. They really make sure that you have this continuity. They will ask you, what about sitting meditation? What about walking meditation? What about daily activities? Were you able to be aware when you're in a bathroom? So our training we got as a monks, there was some continuity. Wake up time was 3 a.m. in Burma. 3 a.m. Mm-hmm. You want to try that? And sleep time was at 10, actually. So we had to continue this practice. And this continuity of practice, you could see actually the benefit of it. Eh? It's like boiling water. When you're boiling water, you actually boil it and then continue the fire until it boils to 100 degrees. But if you boil 1 second and then remove the fire and switch off and then boil again, then it's not going to happen. It's not going to boil it all the way. So anyway, next time you go for the retreat, you want to boil your practice, not warming it, because most people are warming their practice. So next time you have a vacation, go for it. Continue your practice. You will see how you progress in such a short time. See also stands for concentration. Concentration, and try to concentrate and be focused. And then also stands for concurrence. Concurrence of your experience. It's like when you're eating, this is a fork. Huh? When you're eating, how you are going to be concurrent is this is a fork. You have to bring it and it pierce into the piece of tofu, whatever it is. At that moment, it has to be concurrent at the same time. If it doesn't, it's not concurrent, then you are going to, it goes out of the plate because it's not concurrent. So concurrence, basically it means if this is something you're observing, then let the mind observe at the present moment, in the present moment, that experience, not after or before. Maybe it's like lightning, as I told you. If you want to observe lightning, you have to observe as it's arising, not about before or after, right? Before is planning, is that called thinking about it? Thinking about it's not to be personal meditation. Or remembering about the enlightenment. It's already gone. So if concurrence means that you are right there with that enlightenment. Not after or before, but at the moment, synchronizing the moment. Okay, anger rises, nip it in the bud. That's something arising, you become aware of it. If there's touching, this is the surface. I touch it, and my mind is with the touching, not in a chocolate. Right? Some people are touching here like this, but their mind is thinking about chocolates. Then they miss the whole point. So I think that concurrence is very, very important. And then C, there another C there stands for. Okay, three C's I mentioned: continuity, concentration, and then concurrence. Actually, this came, number C, the C here came during my practice with Sadhu Pandita for 1 month at Forest Refuge. And then a monk was interviewing me in 2003. He said, "What's your name?" I said, "Buddha Rakita." He said, Buddha Rakita means the protector of the Buddha. Now you should protect the three C's. Now that was my instruction, to protect the three C's. That means I should protect the continuity of my practice. I should actually concentrate, and I should have what you call concurrence of the experience. I should be concurrent. So that's where I got it from a monk. Now E stands for expectation free. I told you that most people, when they come to practice, they have higher expectations, and that creates a lot of unhappiness. In fact, one of the formula for happiness is reduce your expectations or eliminate. Because actually expectation in meditation, at least, you might expect your profits, that's another thing. But in meditation, in the Dhamma, expectation is a form of loba, very subtle form of loba. Because when there's expectation, there's something, I need to get this, the results, all this kind of thing. But you want to, there's no doubt, there's no problem. You can kind of substitute your expectation with the aspirations. There's no problem with aspiration. Aspirations is not the same as expectation. Aspiration, that means you are putting out your intention there, and then you follow it with skillful effort, right? And then the results will come, but you're not concerned so much on result. So aspiration is not result focused, right? It's process focused. You are focusing on a process. Well, expectation is more goal oriented. When am I going to get these bananas, right? It's more expectation. All right. So now effort also, our friend contributed to be effort. That's fine. Considering that we are doing aspirations, right? Then also effort. East would stand also for effort. Thank you for your contribution. East stands for also for effort, because without effort you cannot do anything. Since now either we are expectation free, another way of saying you are having aspirations, right? So I prefer either, so that it becomes space, so you have space in your practice. So have lots of spaces. Right. So this is another question. This is another one. Oh, this is very interesting also. If the plane caught fire and was diving down, if you were a passenger, what would you do? Sure, there would be fear. What method did you use? Oh, talking about aeroplanes. Okay, do you think anything you can do can help when a plane is there? Actually, aeroplanes, I travel a lot. But one time I was about to land, in Hartford, which is in Connecticut in the USA, and all of a sudden the plane started going up. It has never happened in my life, the plane going up all of a sudden. And there was no announcement. I said, maybe this plane, the landing gear has refused to come out. But actually, later on they made the announcement that actually the airport is busy. But I said, no, this is weird. I've been traveling all these years, nothing has happened like this. So anyway, your question, if the plane caught fire and you are diving down, if you were a passenger, what would you do? Do you just do nothing? Oh, I know what you should do, buckle up. Actually, I've seen many times, whenever there's something comes up, most people who actually have a lot of fear, they are the one who die first. I've seen it again, whether it's a car, whatever, those people who don't keep calmness and all that, they are the one who die first. It happened even recently. This was not an accident. We are sitting in Washington, D.C. There's a student of mine. He's a judge, and whenever I go to USA, he invite me at his home, at her home, and have a sitting group. So she started to suggest to sit on top, on the top of the roof. And then because of sun, she had put some kind of umbrellas, big umbrellas. And we're all seated there, and then the wind came, boom! And then my friend who drove me, he tried to catch the umbrella. I'm telling you, it just missed him like this. If it hit him, he'll lose his jaw, because it was a big umbrella. All of us who are seated, there was no problem. We are seated. Anytime when there's an accident, just keep calm. Yes, because any person who attempts to really save the situation, they're the one who get it rough. So that's what I would do. I just back up and say, Buddha saranam gacchami, Dhammam saranam gacchami, Sangham saranam gacchami. And what can you do with such a big airplane coming down?
Yeah.
Actually, the Buddha mentioned that if at least when you die, your mind is thinking about the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. And for me, actually, during my practice with Bhante Gunaratana, every time before I go to sleep, I would say, every time I would reflect on my life and say, if I don't wake up, what's the last thought that I would like to have? What would be my last word? If, let's say, I wake up and I sleep and I don't wake up, what should be the best thought I should think? I found out the best thing is about Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. So before I sleep, I want us to think about, the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. That should be my last thought in this world. So before you die, better be in that frame of mind where you think about, in fact, as it comes down and about to touch, Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, poof! Not bank account and this and this thing. NZ Bank and whatever amount of money you have and your land is somewhere in Sri Lanka and all these things. Don't take refuge in those things. This is what I would do. I don't know what I would do. That's what I would do. At least when I kaput like this, I'm thinking about the Buddha. Dhamma. Not because I'm Buddha Rakita, but I think it's such a great thing to think about such a great Buddhaham Durari or Naya. Just think about this. I think you will die peacefully. Sure, there will be fear. What method to use? Just remember all the 10 lists I gave in. Good luck. Recognition, acceptance, investigation. Sure, there will be some fear. Yes, definitely. Okay, depends also. You say surely there will be fear. Okay, that's part of the question. Depends. If you are an arahant, there will be no fear. There will be no fear. If you are second return, no fear. If you are second return, fear. First, so on, fear. Because when you are in, you can overcome anger and ill will, vyapada, in the third level. Second level, you attenuate it. Attenuate, and third level, you overcome aversion. Where there's no aversion, there's no fear. There's no fear. So depends who's in a plane. If you are just an ordinary meditator, of course they're going to have fear. If you're first level enlightenment, there'll be a little bit of fear. And then second level, a little bit, more little bit. And then no fear, full enlightenment. So if you don't have fear, please attain final enlightenment. Arahant. And you go all these planes and all these contests and all these things. No problem. Of course, there will be some fear. Yes, I agree, but depends. Because not all people have fear. When you have overcome the root of fear, there's no fear. Even the Buddha said in Dhammapada, the Buddha said, from craving arises fear. Where there's no craving, where is fear? So don't assume everybody has fear. Yeah, not everybody will have fear. What method to use? I've told you the method. Wait until I would patiently wait, and then I say, upgrading. I'm going to upgrade the existence. That's the best thing I can say. Okay, I just keep my mind clear and just wait for another birth. Just wait patiently. What's going to come after this? Am I going to become a monk again or what? I don't know. I don't know what's going to come. So that's the method to use. Just be patient. Just send loving kindness to your loved ones. May my husband, or if you're flying together, or whatever, your relative, send metta to them. May my wife, send metta. May all beings be well up and peaceful. I hope by the time you say may all beings be well up and peaceful. So it's a little bit funny, actually. Such a human being, how we trust that flying coffin. We all actually trust it, actually. Better get a safe one. Actually, Qantas is the safest airline. For New Zealand and Qantas, I started traveling with safer airlines. We have a remote chance of really getting crash, a little bit of crash, Yeah, don't travel by Peru Airlines and Bolivia. And Bolivia, I think, is the worst. It keep on crashing whenever it wants. Actually, even with the whole history of aviation, Qantas Airlines has never had a single soul. Yes, with all its crude flying from the beginning. Recently, they nearly crashed one, which is A380, but still it was because of the manufacture of Rolls-Royce engine, and there was a mismatch, and it caused fire. So one engine caught fire after they left Singapore, and then they had to go to Singapore because it's only 2 hours from flying, and they were heading to Sydney. So they fly back, but it was going to catch fire. But with this, the record of safety, there are five of them looking for the best solution. They managed to land the thing without fire, actually. So there's no single person was hurt, actually. It's amazing. So, but what's very interesting, when I got excited to fly by Qantas, because I usually don't fly Qantas because it's very expensive. So I flew Qantas. Every time I've been in Qantas, they say there's something wrong with the engine. Not very reassuring. Anyway, so if you don't have, you're afraid of flying because the thing will go down, try to get the best airline on earth. That could be a practical thing. Okay, I'm struggling to make an important life decision. What wisdom can we do to make a decision? Very easy decision. Whatever decision you want to do, don't make it out of four. This is found in Digha Nikaya. Digha Nikaya, I think it's Sangita Sutta, talks about four ways of going wrong. What are the four ways of going wrong? Doing something or making a decision out of attachment, out of aversion, out of delusion, and out of fear. If you are doing something which is motivated by greed, hatred, and delusion, and fear, according to that sutta, it's called four ways of going wrong. What are the four ways of going right? Is actually do something or make a decision based on generosity, based on loving kindness and compassion, based on understanding, and based on courage. That should be the template. But who can make such a decision? That should be an arahant who could make these decisions, not based on greed, hatred, and delusion, and fear. Are we yet arahants? No. But can we use that template? Yes. We can use at least that guideline to guide us when we're making decisions, so that when we make a decision, we make an informed decision. So Buddha was the best decision maker. Don't make a decision. Though it's not written that way in the sutta, that making decision, that's what we fall, but we can extrapolate because the Buddha talks about the four ways of going wrong. What are the four ways? Doing something with greed, motivated by greed, hatred, delusion, and fear. Those four things. So if you make an important decision, this is what you should do. First, meditate. Don't make a very important decision in life with a confused mind. Try to meditate. And then sit, meditate. At the end of meditation, then think about your decision. You have a final approach decision. Again, this is not Buddhist, but this is something that I learned as I was studying business. Final approach. If not A, then B, otherwise C. So you have a general idea, all right? Okay, I'll start with A. I'll give it maybe a big chance. And then if not that A, then B. Then that's alternative. Otherwise, see, don't make so many things like five options, 10 options. You'll be confused. But if you choose out of the decision you have to make, you just pick up the best three. Then out of those three, say, if not A, then B, otherwise C. So then you actually meditate, take time to meditate, and then think about again and again. And then you really assess, am I making this decision out of fear? What am I afraid? Am I making this decision out of understanding? Then am I making this decision out of aversion and all that? So once you make the decision, even when it's at least some kind of, when it's tinted by some fear, at least you know that, okay, I was afraid to do this, that's why I made decision. Otherwise, making random decision with confusion and all that, and then you don't know your direction. At least you know the direction that you are taking, whether it's fear and all that thing, or loving kindness and compassion. Sometimes there will be some conflict, you know, things conflicting, but at least with some understanding, you can at least be confident that I've made this decision, and you can accept what are the repercussions when you make a decision. Everything you do and any decision you make, there's always something that is going to affect others. It will affect you, it will affect others, but once you are more aware, then you can work on those areas that you know that they are going to affect you or others.